So again, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Just before I begin the talk this morning, I just want to let you know that next week, the Dharma talk will be given by one of our long-term members, Brandy Kidd. Brandy is one of the leaders of our Naples Sangha. She happens to be in town for our retreat for the Dharma Transmission Group. And I've asked her to give the Dharma talk, sort of like Marcy Meckling several weeks ago. Brandy is a long-term student of the Dharma, but she's also a mother of two children, has a husband, has a full-time career, has a big extended family. She's totally in our lay life, and yet she's a very good practitioner. So I wanted her to share her Dharma with us. And then the following week, we are honored to have giving the Dharma talk a teacher from the Chan. Chan is just the Chinese, the original of Zen. Zen is the Japanese. He's a teacher, a master of Chan Buddhism. His name is Guo Gu. He actually lives in Tallahassee, where he's also a professor. And so he will be with us to lead the meditation and to give a Dharma talk and answer questions. So I invite you to just be attentive. That's what's going to be happening over the next 2 weeks. So what I wanted to talk to you about today is Yogacara. Yesterday we finished. I've been doing a class on Yogacara teaching, which I'll talk about in a minute. It's been for 4 weeks. There have been two classes a week, and then an open forum for participants to ask questions every Saturday of the class. We've had over, I think, 105 members in it, so probably a substantial number of you on this call. We're in that, but a substantial number of you on the call, we're not in that. And I sort of want us, at least generally, to be on the same page, and I think it's so important. Yogacara is so important. Especially for us Americans, or Westerners, or whatever you want to call ourselves, because there may be people on this call who aren't Americans, so to speak. The Yogacara, which means sort of the way of practice, was really the fullest development of Buddhist philosophy and psychology, and really Zen, Chan, the great perfection traditions, Mahamudra, all the great meditative traditions of Mahayana Buddhism are based on Yogacara teaching. We often don't know that. We know the teaching, but I think it's important to see the roots of it, because it's a psychological system as well as a philosophical system. It really helps us understand the path of practice. And so therefore, in our community, we have our paths of practice. And so they are based on your understanding of Yogacara. So so I want to talk to you a little bit about it today in a way that is very understandable. It's a good opportunity for those who do not know to learn something new. And for those of you who are experiencing the Yogacara, just to kind of, it's always good to hear it again. Because actually one of the teachings of the Yogacara helps understand why we need to hear things over and over and over again. Yogacara by itself can kind of get a little intricate, a little deep, but I think its general principles can be understood by anyone. So let me, let me begin with what Yogacara is. Yogacara is often called the mind-only school of Buddhism, consciousness-only school. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean like that, you know, that everything is mind and everything we see out there is just an illusion and, you know, made up. It sort of means that, but it doesn't really mean that. It can be very misinterpreted. But what the mind-only school is telling us, and this is so important for us as practitioners, is that our experience of the world, our experience of things, is all going on within our minds. And then we'll talk about whether that experience of everything in our mind is pure or impure, clear or unclear, is then the important point of practice. But the important, first important thing to understand is everything, all our experiences, our sensory experiences, our thinking experiences, our emotional experiences, memory, I mean, whatever you name, is all only appearing in our minds. This is very fundamental because now we know where things have to be worked on, where we have to look, what has to be cleaned out, what has to be transformed. It is the mind. In Yogacara, it's called mind king, because mind is the king. Speech, actions of the body are servants of the mind. So once one understands or accepts that basic premise that everything is occurring, mediated by the mind, then obviously understanding the mind and how the mind experiences reality, experiences thing, which means us, our own experience, you know, what does that actually mean? So what then Yogacara says is within this mind, there are sort of three subjective, transformative consciousnesses that are occurring, through which all our experience is being transformed. So in other words, rather than thinking, oh, I'm seeing everything clearly, I'm seeing everybody clearly, you know what I mean? Which many of us in our egocentricity we think, in our delusion we think, actually what's going on is these three, and I'll talk about them, the three aspects of our mind are always transforming everything we experience. And then after that transformation occurs, it is that transformation, that end result of the transformation, that is appearing in our mind, and that's what we think is reality. And basically, based on each of us, what we're doing with our experiences, how we're transforming them, has a lot to do with our happiness and our sadness, has a lot to do with our peace of mind, equanimity, capacity to, you know, live fully as human beings, or our capacity to live in delusion, egocentricity, suffering. It's all in the subjective transformations. So, you know, so what Yogacara does for those of us on a path, it gives us a clear understanding of what we're going to encounter, what the obstacles are, and how to overcome them and transform. You know, what do we want to transform into? We want to transform ultimately into an awakened being. What does that mean? That sounds very highfalutin. An awakened being means the same for each of us, that we've actually mined the full wholesome potential of what it means to be a human being, the capacity that all of us have to live fully in the truth of the best things about our nature. Now, many of us listening to this call today, you know, we have read the books. We have heard the talks. We have listened to the podcasts. We have thought about it. And many of us are very clear, yes, I want to walk a path of healing and transformation. I want to be free, or much freer in my life. I want to be happy, right? Now, why doesn't that occur? Why isn't it easy? Why can't we just, you know, read the book, make sense to us, do our own introspection, make sense to us, going to walk a path. Let me just walk it, right? It's easy. Intellectually, it makes a lot of sense. Yogacara explains what the problem is, okay? It explains it in these three subjective transformations. So the first subjective transformation that we're all experiencing is what's called the upper six levels of consciousness, right? And this is really the only level of our experience that we're really aware of, to our detriment, right? And this is why we're so easily fooled, right? So how do we know the world? We see. I mean, let's take, you know, let's say, how do you know another person, right? How do you know the people you live with? How do you know your relatives, your family, your colleagues, the people you love, your children, your parents? How do you know them? You see them. You hear their voices. I guess you could smell them. You could taste them. And usually that's not the way we do it. You know, if we were perhaps a dog, we would go, yeah, how do I know the world? I smell it and I taste it. You know, we're human beings, we're a little different. But, you know, so I wouldn't, you know, that's how they know the world. Okay. So we know the world through our five senses. But again, even science tells us that the way our seeing, or the organ of our eyes, our hearing, you know, how we perceive things, how they appear to us in our mind, are not actually as they are. We are actually subjectively transforming our experiences, even of our senses, as they occur, right? Now, human beings, we have a sixth sense. That is what's called our consciousness, but in this sense, we might say, this is our thinking mind, okay? So this is the world of language. This is the world of images, right? This is the world of various kinds of formal aspects of the thinking mind. Besides generating thoughts, we can name, we can label, we can reflect on, we can think about. We have the capacity of thinking somewhat logically. We have the capacity of thinking analytically. We have the capacity of categorizing, liking, you know, disliking. So what's going on at the level of mind that we're aware of is our senses, our five senses, are always giving us data. And our thinking mind are present to all the data that's coming into these five. And it is interpreting. It is categorizing all the data that's coming in based on its own way of thinking and perceiving. It is not based on any real reality. It's turning what sensory experience, it's turning it into language. And the language we're using is all, you know, what we're used to. Okay? You know, we have our words. That's how we categorize experience. All right. So this is all going on, you know, moment to moment. We're all having experience, thoughts, you know, all different kinds of sensory experience. We're constantly thinking about, our experiences, you know, all that stuff. That's our thinking mind. I mean, it's in our thinking mind that we think about, I'm going to change. You know, the thinking mind has the capacity to reflect. Yeah, this is not really working. Yeah, something's wrong here. Something's wrong in my mind, you know. Something's wrong in my emotional life. Something's wrong in my relationship. Something's wrong in work. Oh, this is working. I really love this. This is great. This is wonderful. This is all going on in these upper levels of our mind. Is that clear? But if you notice, all our sensory experience, and especially our thinking mind, is all interruptible. It's not like constant. It goes here, it jumps there. You see, I mean, we can endlessly think different things, contradictory things, you know, one after the other, right? You know, so there's something totally unstable about our thinking mind, which perhaps gives you an understanding of why you can, you know, wake up in the morning, have the strongest intention of the world, how you're going to be today, be very clear in your thinking mind, and then it's gone. Right? You can really be very, you can think and reflect, yeah, I'm going to really, I got to change my life. I got to really be a lot more mindful, a lot more present. I got to, you know, learn to let go of things. I got to, right? We think about all these things, right? And then what happens? Well, you know what happens. It works, it doesn't work. It's in, it's out. So the Yogacarans said there's got to be something else that's going on than these upper six levels of consciousness. Because one of the big things that's going on is, even though there's no continuity up here in this realm where we were conscious, there seems to be, I mean, some sense of continuity in my life. In other words, like, I think I'm me. And I think that everything that's happened, ever happened, is happening, you know, is all about me, right? Now, that seems to be constant. And even the interesting things, when it's really interrupted, such as we fall asleep, right? We sleep for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours. Or even if we pass out, go into a coma, right? When we come out of it, we remember, you know, the sense of me is still here. And all our stories from the past about who I am, all our narratives, they seem to be here too. And yet when you look into your thinking mind, there's nothing constant. You see, it's all interruptible. So the Yogacarans said, no, something else is going on here. And there seems to be something that is always influencing us up here. You know, we like this, we don't like this, we approve of this, we don't approve of this, we align ourselves with this, and we are totally against that, you know? Right? Where's that coming from? You know, it can't be coming from our thinking mind, because when we look into our thinking mind, we don't find anything of any kind of stability. All we find is these thoughts coming and going. Everybody, one of us, we sit in meditation, what do we notice? Thoughts coming and going, thoughts, you know, no rhyme or reason to them. Sometimes we can direct them, but really, why is anything arising? So the Yogacarans said there's got to be something else here. Now, they didn't ask it just because they had a lot of time on their hands. Thought, well, let's investigate this. Because these were practitioners. They wanted to awaken. They wanted to be free. And they saw that just this understanding of the six consciousnesses doesn't really explain what's going on. There has to be something else. So, by inference, using logic, analysis, etc., they inferred there is this alaya, this kind of subconscious part of the mind that seems to be running the show. So for all of you who have all these kinds of thoughts, all these kinds of intentions, all this, and wonder, you know, right, or you, you know, I'm, you know, I am not going to get angry at this person anymore, right? No matter what. Today, I'm not going to, right? And then what happens? See, like, there's something else running the show that keeps pulling us in a certain direction. And it's not conscious, but yet we know it. Right? So there were two things they kind of looked at. One was this sense of self, and you remember in Buddhism, it is this identification with self, which is this fundamental kind of cause of our suffering. You know, why is this so pernicious and so constant, and why does it seem to control my thinking processes? You know, this sense of I, me, my, right? As well as, where does all this stuff, you know? I mean, they didn't use the word stuff, we use the word stuff. Where's all this stuff coming from? All my issues, all my problems, you know, like, where are they coming from? Right? I look around, I don't see them. Anybody, you look around wherever you are. I mean, did you see them? Do you see your issues? You see your childhood issues, your problems? You don't, it's not here, okay? Not conscious. So, these are the two issues. And what they posited, and this is very important, they posited that in this alaya, this deeper consciousness, this deeper aspect of the mind, right? So first we have these upper six. There are two other most important subjective consciousnesses that are transforming our experience. Skewing, okay, what we experience. All of us, not just, some, all of us. This is a common human experience. Is that clear? Now, let me take, you know, and what they posited is that as opposed to these upper six, including the thinking mind, this storehouse is the biggest aspect of the mind, the most significant aspect of the mind. Okay, because what they did and what they called the storehouse consciousness, the eighth level, is the idea was that as we act in life in our thoughts, in our emotions, in our speech, and in our behavior, all these actions of ourselves in life are leaving an impression in the storehouse consciousness. Or another way to say it is, all these actions of body, speech, and mind that we are always participating in is dropping a seed down into our storehouse consciousness. Another way they said it is that all these actions that we do have a certain perfume, have a certain odor, okay? And they are dropping down into our storehouse consciousness. So whichever way you want to imagine it. And that this storehouse consciousness stores all these things, right? And as you can imagine, if you started storing things, they store things kind of like to like. So all your anger, all your irritation, those seeds are all there. And the more of those you have, the bigger area of the storehouse it takes up, right? All your pleasures, all your pains, all your fears, everything. Your actions are stored in your storehouse consciousness. Now, the important thing is we not see this as like a fixed thing. This is just kind of an image, a metaphor, all right? Because this is actually very dynamic. So what's happening is we up here, we see, we smell, we taste, we touch, we think, we feel, we all this stuff. This is all dropping seeds down. These seeds, there are already a lot of seeds down there. These seeds are being constantly in process, and they come back up, right? So there's an endless process of seeds going down, seeds being activated and manifesting, right? This is a process that is going on all the time. It goes on in our waking consciousness. It goes on in our sleep. This is what dreams are coming from. Is that clear? And so the fact that we feel, even though up here we think we have free will and we're making free choices, actually everything that we are doing is going on in this realm of being conditioned by what's in our storehouse. Is that clear? And what the analogy they use, which is, I think is a very meaningful analogy, is they use the analogy of a large eggplant. Think about an eggplant. It is a large eggplant. You know, 95% of it is this large black fruit. At the top, there is this little green top, right? Just nod your heads if you agree. Everybody, so they say that the alaya is that big part of the eggplant. And the green on top is our upper six levels of consciousness. Okay, so it is this subconscious region which holds all the seeds of our experience, which is constantly conditioning what's happening up here in the conscious level, what we're conscious of. Is that clear? So now there's one missing thing, which is I'm talking about a process of seeds, of endlessly fertilizing, feeding, conditioning. It's like this process. So where does this sense of self come from? Why do I think that all this is happening to me? You know, and I'm this separate, discrete entity. This is just a process. Well, what they said is there's something called the manas, M-A-N-A-S. And the manas, we don't need to go into its derivation, they have how it came into being. But the manas, we might say, is the intermediary between the storehouse and the upper levels. Right? The manas is the self, is the ego. It's the sense of individuation. And it is the seat of our narcissism. Manas takes everything because it has no real existence of its own. So what does it take as me? It looks primarily to the storehouse and says, all these things, they're me. They look up to the upper level, to the realm of thoughts and experience at the upper level, and they say, that's also me. It's all me, right? And because it's an intermediary, as the impressions go down, they are tinged with me. As all the stuff comes up, it's tinged with me. And so basically, you get to a point where we, now I'm talking about us practitioners, who am I? We think that's who I am. Who am I? Are my thoughts, are my feelings, are my memories, are my stories? You know, this is me. And I'm a permanent, solid thing. And yet, what do we know? The truth is, there's no permanent, solid thing. There's just these processes, upper level, constantly changing. You know, photons, neutrons, whatever goes on in seeing and hearing. You know, if you look at the science of it, it's just endlessly, you know, moment to moment unfolding, right? The storehouse endlessly sending up and putting down, right? It's a total, it's all in flux, and the truth is, it's really not me. Right? We sit in meditation. Thoughts arise, feelings arise, you know, impulses arise, desires arise. They're all endlessly arising, right? If you ask yourself, are they really happening because of me? Are they under my control? Am I telling these things to happen? Absolutely not. So there is this total process in fluctuation of these eight consciousnesses, and yet manas claims and says, this is me, and I'm stable, and I'm solid, and I'm real, and I am different than you. That's called the world of duality. I'm here, you're out there. Now again, that's all based on this sense of individuation, which according to Yoga Currents, isn't real. Real meaning it feels real. But when one looks, one cannot find a self, right? So it's a fabrication. Now, so what, you might say? Well, because as we live life under the delusion that we are a separate self, our life unfolds. We feel separate from others. We feel separate from life. Even in truth, as I said, everything's arising in mind. How could I feel separate from what's arising in my own mind? But because everything is being seen through the eyes of this self, right? We see ourselves as separate from everything. And so when we look at the world, internal and external, you know, as we encounter and make contact with the world, we find there's pleasure and there's pain and there's neutrality. The self naturally goes, because it's a narcissist, always goes toward what? Pleasure. It always avoids pain. And it's always bored by the neutral. There's nothing in it for me. So self gets very active. Desiring, wanting, needing, averting, getting away from, not wanting, attaching, grasping, holding on, pushing away. So all of a sudden we find our lives totally consumed by what? Attachment, aversion, liking, disliking, wanting pleasure, seeking to get away from pain. You know, and this again, the self is a narcissist. We're always thinking, what is the most pleasurable thing? To be noticed. To be loved, to be liked, right? To be successful, right? To experience pleasure, right? This is the most wonderful thing for self. Revels in it. The problem is what? It doesn't want the other side. You know, it's catastrophic not to be liked, not to be loved, not to be thought worthy, not to be successful, not to win, you know. You know, not to have pleasure, but to have pain. I mean, it's so self is, you know, to live in the world of self is to live in this world of endlessly, up and down, up and down, up and down, right? Wanting this, pushing away that. That's the drama of self. Is that clear? And it's all, you know, the way it unfolds in each of our lives is conditioned by each of our subjective consciousnesses. So, why is this important? Because it answers the question, the conundrum that we each have is, why, since I get it up here, is the path of practice and transformation so hard for me? Why doesn't it just work? Anybody ever ask yourself that question? Why do you get frustrated? Why do you even kind of go, you know? And of course, what do? We blame ourselves. A self that doesn't really exist. I mean, we you know, it's like we compound the problem. Or else we blame the teaching, we blame the teacher, you know, everything. But when you understand what I just presented very quickly, we understand if I want to transform, then I have to transform my seeds. Right? There's something rotten in Denmark. Is that clear? And it's our own storehouse. See, we think there's something rotten outside here with everybody else in the world. No, the rot is in ourselves. That's where the garbage is. It's in our storehouse and in our manas, this self that's so is so in love with itself, so in love with its thoughts, its opinions, its ideas, its perspective on things, right? So attached to that. Conceit. Yeah, so we realize that, yes, we can get it up here at the thinking level of consciousness, but the transformation has to occur in the alaya, in the storehouse and in the manas. Right? Oh, see, this is wonderful, right? Because now I know what I need to do. That as long as I'm up here, it's never going to work. Because one, this is not where the real source of the problem is, and two, this is always interruptible. While, I don't know if I might have forgotten to say, while the storehouse consciousnesses, both the storehouse and the manas, the seeds, the sense of self, they're continuous. They're continuous. In other words, that's why we always, you go to sleep, with yourself and its issues, and you wake up in the morning with yourself and issues, right? I mean, people can be in comas for how long? People can be in coma for days, weeks, and months. And when they wake up, slowly, if they return, they will return to who they are. Which means what? They'll return to their sense of self with all their stories. And they might even pick up where they left off, even though they've been in a coma for 3 months. Like, what's that about? You see. Now, I mean, obviously, there's a lot more to this, but I'm trying to be simple today. Okay, so at the intellectual level, the cognitive level, the reflective level, we have enough awareness that we can see that there are certain things about the way we're living, the way we're feeling, that just aren't working, just don't feel right. We find out there is another way to live, there is another way to be. We know that there are practices to do. That is where we have to begin. Again, this is important. We cannot, each of us, cannot see our storehouse consciousness or our manas. We can't get in there and work in there. All we can work on is when it arises. That's how we know it's there. Is that clear? You know, that's how you got a dead squirrel in the attic. Okay, everybody ever have a dead squirrel or a dead rat? You smell it. Oh. And if you're smart enough and reflect, you think, what? I think I can track this down. I mean, can you see? It's like a medical with a disease. You know, like, what's the cause? There has to be a cause. You know, so we're up here but we have the symptoms, you see. And it is the symptoms that will tell us what the disease is, and it's at this level of our body that we have to make the changes. This is where we're treated, you see. So, this is practice now. This is the key piece here. So we have our storehouse, and very simply, the way the Yogacarans did, because again, they want to make it simple, it's about practice, that basically they kind of divided up all mind states and their concurrent emotional states as wholesome and unwholesome. Okay, positive or negative, wholesome, unwholesome. That's really the term they use. And there's a list of 51. I recommend that you read it because you'll get the map. And basically it says, you know, observe yourself. Listen, you know, not just how you act in the world, what you experience in your own mind. I mean, that gives us a better sense of what's going on inside us, you know. And what we're primarily experiencing throughout the day are wholesome and unwholesome manifestations of the seeds that are in our consciousness. And it is by mindfulness and reflection and transformation at the conscious level that we are beginning the process of transforming our storehouse. This is the only way to do it. As long as we are just working at the conscious intellectual level, you know, it doesn't mean that we cannot, through our thinking process, kind of make things better, but it's a very limited way. Because as I said, you know, the this is the eggplant, right? And as long as we're working at the tip, you know, we're not getting at, you know, where the problem is. So the key piece is I know that for me to transform, I have to transform my storehouse consciousness. How do I do that? When it manifests. Okay? So whenever an unwholesome seed arises, an unwholesome mind state arises, an unwholesome thought arises, again, you have your list of criteria, you know wholesome from unwholesome, I need to do something right then and there. Now again, this is in our community, there are many different ways, or at least a few basic ways that we can practice with the seeds when they arise, with the mind states that they arise. But basically, quite simply, we have to stop the conscious or even unconscious cultivation of unwholesome seeds. If we want a beautiful garden, we cannot be always cultivating weeds and be disappointed that we don't have a beautiful garden. And again, the cultivation of unwholesome seeds is primarily what's going in our mind all day. Which means, you know, you could be sitting on the toilet all alone and cultivating unwholesome seeds in your mind, which are just intensifying those formations in our alaya, in our storehouse. Right? So the non-cultivation of negative seeds, unwholesome seeds, when they have arisen, we know that we can do that through mindfulness and awareness and reflection. And the conscious non-cultivation, which it has to do with intentionality, I am going to do my best not to cultivate unwholesome mind states, not to cultivate anger, not to cultivate jealousy, not to cultivate envy, not to cultivate fear, not to cultivate living in the future, not to cultivate ruminating about the past, right? I mean, all these unwholesome mind states, we can do our best not to cultivate. We can do our best when they have arisen because they're in my storehouse, not to give them any play, right? And most importantly, the most important way we change our storehouse is what we put into it. We still have the storehouse, right? And so we are much more deliberate, intentional in our cultivation of the wholesome. Wholesome thoughts, wholesome feelings, wholesome ways of speaking, wholesome interactions, wholesome habits, right? When, because of our past, you know, we all have wholesome seeds. When they arise, just because they're already in our storehouse, we are aware that wholesome mind state has arisen in me, and I do my best to maintain it. But even more importantly, I am very consciously cultivating wholesome mind states throughout my day, in all my relationships. So this is why we say transformation goes on all day. Why, if we're only practicing on our cushion, we're only practicing in short periods of time, but the rest of the day we're just letting everything fly, well, what's going to fly is what? Our storehouse. And let me not forget Manas. Remember, that's the other big one. And Manas is skewing everything to be about itself. So once we understand that it's not a real thing, but it's a condition identification, that is why we more and more engage in selfless altruistic activity, thinking more of others, others' concerns, others' needs, others' happiness, not so self-centered. So we soften our identification with self. And again, as you know, I mean, there's a whole meditative path that we teach here, which actually, this can all be, we can actually, the good thing, we can see directly into our minds and actually see there's no self there. We can actually have a direct experience of our non-selfness, and we can actually have an experience of what is at the base of our consciousness, which is just pure awareness, undefiled, uncontaminated, pure awareness. Through meditation, we can have an experience of that. Which is, you know, we know that we are not, we are more than the seeds that are endlessly arising and passing, we might say. Now we know they go back down. If you ever wonder where your seeds go, that's where they're going. We just can't see it, but that's where they're going. So we can actually touch the undefiled nature of the mind. It's sort of like, you know, I'm sort of looking, there's a screen in the back, and on the screen, you're being projected. You know, I mean, the windows, you know, the little Zoom window screens on there. And so I see all of you. I see your, I see some of you, I see your faces, for some I see your names. See, that's the conditioned world. But it's all being projected onto a white screen, you see. To know that, when you know your pure consciousness, you know the screen in which all your thoughts, feelings, perceptions are being projected onto. You know the temporariness of all of this. You know, images can be endlessly projected onto the white screen. The white screen's always white, always there. And we'll just, you know, and that's another thing about our storehouse consciousness. It's very much like the screen. Whatever is projected onto it, it has no bias, like a storehouse. You know, you can store anything you want in it, right? You can store junk, and you could store valuable antiques. Storehouse will hold it anything, right? It doesn't. So, I mean, don't look to the storehouse to save us. Storehouse will store anything. You know, if you want to store all your garbage there, it'll take the garbage, right? Right. But it's those of us living at the upper levels. We're the ones who want to transform and change. So, I mean, there's a lot more that can be said, but why don't we stop now? We don't have too much time. Bill is in the back. If you have any questions about what I've shared today in terms of basic Yogacara, let me just say the book we use in the class is called Living Yogacara. There's a lot of stuff on Yogacara. Most of it is academic, which is, you know, hard to get your head around unless you're really trained in, you know, on ontological, epistemological way of thinking. I mean, it's very, which actually, way back in India and right today, these are what the monastics trained in. But Living Yogacara is a good, oriented toward lay people, Living Yogacara. But anyhow, so if you have any questions, please chat them in and Bill will relay them to me just about anything that was shared today, but most importantly in these last few minutes, about practice. Yogacara is the path of practice. All these understandings, teachings are to help us know the terrain of our mind. Why? So we cannot, you know, not be ambushed, not despair, not get frustrated. We know, oh, you know, this is the path. And when these obstacles arise, we know what they are. Yes.
Can you touch on where Vedana or Vedana, the enunciation, fits in the Yogacara?
Yeah, so this is, you know, the basic, I mean, when you see the wholesome and unwholesome seeds, there are certain experiences, human experience, that are just common to everything. And Vedana, which means when we just in the immediacy of contact, the eyes see an object, the ears hear a sound, smell, you know, odors, or even the contact of the mind consciousness with its own thoughts. In that initial contact, there is a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling. That's the Vedana. And that is already then begins to move us. Now, what has conditioned our Vedana, our liking, disliking, pleasure, pain? It's our storehouse. So even that's getting into it, but that is why even when we think we're having a pure experience, we're not. Because even in that immediate contact, what we like, what we don't like, what we think is pleasurable or unpleasurable is already being conditioned by us, by our experience, by our storehouse. Yes, Bill.
If the storehouse consciousness runs the show, then how is it that I can cause change? Is it simply a process of doing our best?
Well, again, the storehouse consciousness runs the show when we're unconscious. Most of us are unconscious. The storehouse and the manas are running the show because we're not aware that they're running the show. When we become aware that it's only because we're unconscious, unmindful, don't know another way, that our conditioned, you know, our conditioned response, I mean, this is just, you know, psychology, our conditioned response, our conditioned way of being, our conditioning at all levels will run us. And as long as we live from our conditioning, as long as we live from the historical way we're doing it, we will never change because it is continuous. Okay. So, manas only runs the show if we let it run the show. Where can we revolt? Where can we rebel? Where can we say no? No. Yes. Yes. That happens in our conscious mind. That's why we should never be frustrated with our thinking mind. We just don't know how to use it correctly. So it is in our, if we want to know what our conditioning is, we have to be, you know, we have to develop that objectivity, that self-reflective. This is why reflection is such an important part of the Dharma and of Yogacara. When things arise, when we feel things, when we have impulses, when we have desires, when we have all kinds of thoughts, there has to be a part of us that can reflect on what's arising, can name it, wholesome, unwholesome. This is just my conditioned response. This is my historical response. Call it whatever you want. This is my mother. This is my father. You know, you can call it whatever you want, you know, but you name it. And because we're walking a path, we know that one, we can't stop it from arising. It is our conditioning. But with self-awareness and mindfulness, we have the freedom to choose. That's why in Buddhism we say, practice begins with the second thought. Right? First thought we have no control over. It just arises. First impulse, first what desire, first, you know, liking or disliking something. Right? You know what I'm saying? Right? It's like, working with the grandchildren, right? I mean, you know, they look at something and they don't like it. Yuck. And what does the parent say? Well, hold on a second, you know, have you ever tried it? Or, you know, it's like, oh, there is, you know, It can be done. We need to learn to be with that way with ourselves. When we're aware that a negative affliction, a mind state, way of being, way of acting, way of being in the world, you know, we don't want to do that anymore. It's still going to arise, especially if it's something that's very habitual with us. But if we can be aware when it arises, that's for thought, we can't prevent that. We see it, we're aware, we label it, we know that it's one of the ones that we don't want to cultivate, so we don't cultivate it. We remember, what is it I do want to cultivate? We cultivate that. That's how we change our storehouse. Yeah, that's where our freedom is. Our freedom is not going backwards. Our freedom is not in our condition. Our freedom is not in our history. That's what happened, right? You know, we cannot change our childhood. We cannot change our family, can we? They are who they are. But what can we change? Ourselves. That's where the freedom is. And the freedom can only be taken based on how conscious we are, how aware we are, and whether we're going to use, let's say, the template of Dharma to help us clearly see. I mean, that's the beauty of having this map. You know, that's the beauty of having a map, right? You know, we don't have to slog through the woods. You know, we don't have to slog through the jungle. We don't just have to keep slogging through the desert. I have a map. I can follow the map. I have a guidebook. It describes, you know, everything I'm going to see. I can know, you know, when I come to a fork in the road, to take the left turn or the right turn. How easy it is. Of course, this gets into another problem. A lot of us, based on our conditioning, you know, we think we know best. I mean, that's another one of our big seeds. That's another one of our ego things. We think we know best. You know, how could we know best, especially when you study Yogacara, when you really realize that your knowing best is all based on your storehouse and your manas? I mean, you know, that's just what it is. So that's why, especially in the early stages of practice, we have to trust, we have to rely on some body of experience and wisdom, you know, that's not our conditioned way of doing things. Because our conditioned way of doing things only knows the way we've done it, only thinks the way we've always thought, only feels the way we've only feel, only responds to things in the way it's always responded. That's what it does. You know? And if we think that we can change it by grappling with it and struggling with it, no, it'll never change that way. You're just entering its world. The Buddhist path of transformation is to understand the past is past. The effects of the past will affect us by arising in the present. If we are practicing mindfulness, awareness, you know, and we have a good template, when things arise in the present, that's the moment of transformation. That's the moment of healing in the present. But that can only happen if we're aware, self-reflective. Maybe time for one more.
Does Yogacara say anything about when one can see the unwholesome seeds arising, knows better than to cultivate them, and chooses to cultivate them anyway?
Say what?
Does Yogacara say anything about when one can see the unwholesome seeds arising, knows better than to cultivate them, and chooses to cultivate them anyway?
The negative. Yeah, I mean, has anybody ever had that experience? Of course. Why is that? Remember what's big? What's big? Storehouse. What's small? Conscious. Okay? We have to, what we're doing in our practice is strengthening ourselves at the conscious level. Right? At this point, our conscious mind is very weak. It is controlled by manas. It is controlled by the storehouse. right? You know, that's where it's taking its orders from, right? But again, we have this power of self-reflection. It is wonderful. Animals don't have that. You know, they can't stop what's going on in their life. They cannot stop, step back from their life and go, you know, is there a better way? You know, I mean, these squirrels, you know, I mean, where we live now, I mean, they're, you know, it's acorn season. I mean, their whole life is about acorns. You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, you know, do they ever stop and think, is there more to life? You know, and spending your days eating acorns and looking over your shoulders that the cats don't get you. I mean, you know. You know, we have that ability. You see? But again, if you're in that position where, you know, you say, you know, people often say, I think that question is, you know, but, you know, what if you still do it when you know better? Well, the truth is, your knowing better isn't that strong yet. And your historical conditioning is stronger. The only way your knowing better is going to get stronger is if you listen to it. Yeah, so at the end of the day, you do your best to listen to it. You know, there is that saying in certain worlds, you know, fake it till you make it. You know, sometimes you know, even though you have a strong impulse, you know it's probably best not to follow it, right? Even though you really want to. It's the same way you kind of, you know, there's just something you want to say, and yet there's a part of you knows, I should not say it. Right? It's only going to make things worse, and yet what? There we go again. You know, Shantideva, he gives the advice, be a log. Great advice. Be a log, he says. You know, if you can't, you know, if you know this is not the right thing to do, or if you don't know the right thing to do, at least you can always be a log. Just don't do anything. Give some space. So yeah, so that's, I mean, again, so that's a common issue. You know, that's how we have to just keep working it, you know, strengthen our ability to live a conscious life, to make good choices, wise choices for ourselves. I mean, that's what we teach our children, right? It would be nice if we could teach that to ourselves. Maybe one more quick one. Is there just a quick one? We have about 3 minutes. No, well, maybe I can give a quick answer to a...
All this, the Yogacara teachings, affect the physical body, how to interpret disease.
Yeah, that's a big one. You know, in Buddhist teaching, Yogacara, body and mind are one, and actually, it does say that actually the storehouse, the seat of the storehouse, is the body. I mean, it gets quite, I don't want to go into it because I think most of us wouldn't understand it or accept it, but it really says that our body is the product of our storehouse. I mean, this is getting off the subject, what's on the subject, but, you know, rebirth, the idea of the continuation of consciousness has been traditionally very central, you know, just the way Buddhists, you know, see the unfolding of experience. If you understand the template of the eight consciousnesses, what happens at death is the upper six die with the body. But it is the alaya, it is all the seeds and the sense of self in the alaya, that's what continues on. And that actually is what forms a new body, or the seeds for the body. So in that sense, you know, body and mind are one, and the mind, especially the storehouse, is conditioning our body. And again, but it's not like determinism, because in Yogacara it says, you know, it's causes and conditions, so it's a very fluid situation. You know, I mean, we can have, like, you know, we can have a certain kind of body, but how we take care of it can have a lot to do whether the symptoms manifest or not, right? So, I mean, it's not deterministic, you know. I mean, so we can have all kinds of conditioning, and yet we can work with it and transform it. Anyhow, so it's 10 of. Why don't we stop now?